Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today is Peter Walls, manager of Unicorn Master Trust, a fund of investment trusts. It's been a strong year for investment trust initial public offerings, or IPOs for short, with 15 by the end of October amounting to $2.61 billion, and so far this month another two. But a key differentiator between what has been coming to market this year and many of the issues of the past decade is that a number of launches have a focus on growth and invest in equities rather than investing in high-yielding alternative assets. Peter, for years, investment trust launches have been dominated by funds which invest in unusual assets and offer high yields. So why the sudden change?
Well, actually, I don't think the trends of recent years have changed particularly, as we've seen, you know, further issuance of interesting trusts in the alternative space, from music streaming to energy storage funds, plus a fintech specialist and an activist fund that intends to make a single investment. So, you know, I think that demand for the alternatives continues. And meanwhile, there's been plenty of secondary issuance, primarily by higher income producing trusts in areas such as property, infrastructure and renewable energy. Encouragingly, a growing number of conventional equity trusts have also been successful in raising further capital, led most notably, I think, by Scottish Mortgage Trust, which actually expanded by almost $300 million in the first 9 months of the year. I'm not sure if there's been a sudden change in attitudes to conventional equity new issues. Although until recently, average discounts were quite narrow, and many trusts traded at or above net asset value. So overall sentiment was quite supportive. As ever, launching an equity trust without the promise of an attractive dividend can be tricky, especially if markets take a turn for the worse. So the fact that we've seen quite a few more launches recently could just be a flash in the pan.
Okay. Now, what would be an example of one of these more conventional equity trusts?
The Smithson Investment Trust was actually the largest ever issue, raising $822 million. Smithson invests globally in small and mid capitalization companies. And the trust, I think, is a logical and pragmatic extension to the large cap process employed by the open-ended Fundsmith Equity Fund, which is simply too big to invest in relatively smaller companies. I say relatively here because the average size of the companies in the new trust is more than £7 billion. It's logical, I think, because the companies that have outperformed the strong track record of the open-ended fund are most commonly small and mid-cap businesses. And pragmatic because I think the closed-end structure of an investment company will facilitate better liquidity and portfolio management for the new trust.
Now, Smithson, as you said, was incredibly successful in its fundraising, but have all the conventional equity investment trust launches been popular?
Most of the other recent launches haven't actually raised the maximum targets they set out to, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were not popular. Mobius raised $100 million. They were looking for $200 million. But that was against a backdrop of uncertain emerging markets. And Baillie Gifford US Growth raised an initial $173 million, but has subsequently issued additional shares worth $46 million, which implies to me that there's ongoing popularity in this area.
Have you invested Unicorn Master Trust in any of these launches?
Yes, I supported the Smithson launch and also AVI Japan Opportunity Trust. Much has been written on the Smithson Trust, so I don't really intend to repeat the story here. But essentially, I do believe in the smaller companies effect, both in the UK and international markets, and have a long-term structural bias to the area. AVI Japan's managers believe there are extraordinary undervaluations in a range of cash-rich, overcapitalized Japanese smaller companies. They anticipate that corporate governance reform and shareholder activism will help to unlock this value. we're seeing greater number of non-executive directors appointed to Japanese companies, and there's a much greater focus on return on equity. So if you look at their initial portfolio, it's estimated to have more than 70% of the market capitalizations of the underlying companies covered by net cash and investment securities in businesses that aren't particularly relevant to their underlying businesses. What I liked about this issue was that if things don't go according to plan, investors have the opportunity to get their money back at net asset value in 4 years' time.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the possibility of things, you know, not going great, which I suppose is, you know, an issue when you buy a new fund. So would you say generally, is it a good idea to invest in an investment trust, an IPO?
Well, I think you need to be very selective. I think in the last decade, including these two recent issues that I've supported, I've only made five investments in investment trust IPOs. I would caveat by saying that a lot of the alternative funds haven't particularly appealed to me because I don't have an overriding requirement for income. I'm looking for total return, and it's a capital growth policy that I'm following. And in some cases, you know, there may well be quite a significant J-curve effect where it may take time for the initial investments to be made and even more time for them to come to fruition. So there might be better times to buy some of these strategies.
We've been talking about equity launches this year and describing them as conventional, but how conventional are these equity trusts which have come to market?
Well, I think if you're talking in terms of conventional in the sense of some of the global funds like Foreign and Colonial or Witan or Alliance Trust, then clearly these are more specialised. And I think it's unlikely that we'll see many true plain vanilla issues, as the real benefits of the investment structure are to be able to invest in specialist areas which may be illiquid. And I think all of these funds play to the strengths, but clearly one has to have a diversified portfolio before considering some of the more specialist offerings that are coming to market.
Mm. I mean, just taking as an example, Baillie Gifford's US fund, which launched this year, is considered to be a conventional US equity fund, but in fact can actually invest 50% of its assets in quoted. And even Avi Japan, it's focusing on smaller companies in Japan, kind of special situations, going to have quite concentrated portfolios. So they're not quite your average equity fund. Does this mean that trusts like this or maybe higher risk, and you know, what do investors need to consider before putting their money into, let's say, an equity fund that's maybe not quite your average equity fund?
Well, the greater the specialisation, the higher the risk. And really, one has to consider the overall exposure of one's portfolio in terms of diversification, both by industry and by geographical area. And really, you know, these specialist funds should constitute a much smaller part of one's overall portfolio.
Okay. Now, I suppose one of the themes is building up an allocation to unquoted investments. There's existing trusts that do that. Some of the new launches have done that. Do you think that more investment trusts in mainstream equity sectors are going to start to build up an allocation to unlisted companies?
I think there'll certainly be a temptation to do so. I feel that the ever-increasing grip of passive funds will encourage some large active managers to consider moving more into this area. But I think one should consider this with a great deal of forethought. Perhaps most famously in the world of investment companies, and we saw it quite recently in their interim results, Scottish Mortgage has been very successful in its investments in what tend to be unicorn-type businesses. And in fact, the performance of their unlisteds has been better than the stellar performance of their listed portfolios. But one has to remember that Baillie Gifford had been looking at this area for many, many years now and have built up a lot of expertise. I don't think it's the sort of thing that every active manager should be looking at. But my cynical side suggests that threat of the passives will encourage more and more to try and differentiate themselves from the listed markets. You know, these unicorn companies, you know, are very exciting. They're fast approaching 300 startup companies valued at more than £1 billion. So it's a big market with a total value of 900 billion now. You know, clearly there's been an awful lot of excitement there. I sort of feel that against a backdrop of slowing global growth over the next couple of years and the move from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening, that there might be better times to look at these areas. So I'd certainly be cautious about a wholesale switch and move of many investment companies going into this area.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Some really useful points. In this week's issue of Investors Chronicle, our annual investment trust special issue, we asked four managers of funds of investment trusts, including Peter, to make some suggestions for growth, income, wealth preservation and diversification. Peter, your suggestion for growth was Baillie Gifford UK Growth Fund. Why did you pick this investment trust?
Well, first of all, the management of this trust has changed recently. It's moved from Schroders, where it struggled a little bit. It had a number of changes of managers, and the board decided that it was time to review the management agreement, and they moved it to Baillie Gifford. The new team there is highly regarded. It's got a very good track record in managing this sort of process. And at present, there is a bit of a stock overhang in the shares. So they're trading at a discount of around about 7%. And that overhang comes from the former Schroders savings scheme, where investors in the scheme are being given the opportunity to either switch into a Schroders product or to effectively sell their investment. This overhang should be cleared early next month. And thereafter, I think Baillie Gifford will be quite forthright in promoting this trust as their flagship for UK exposure in the investment trust world. So a good management team, a technical situation which I think will be overcome. And if you look at the ratings of most other Baillie Gifford trusts, you'll probably find that a move towards asset value or above will be in prospect in the medium-term future.
I mean, this sounds like a really good opportunity. And yes, Baillie Gifford does have a good record. But what are the risks of buying into this trust just now?
Well, clearly, as the name suggests, it is a growth-oriented trust. And, you know, growth has been the area which has been favoured most by investors, not only in the UK, but internationally in recent years. So it's a question really of how much people are willing to pay for that growth. If you look at the other side of the equation, which is value-based investing, you'll see that the piece of elastic between value and growth has been stretched and stretched and stretched in the good times. And the question is whether there's any pullback on that differential in ratings.
Now, for income, you suggested Edinburgh Investment Trust, but this has been underperforming the FTSE All-Share Index for around 3 years. What made you pick this one?
Well, I think it really appealed to my contrarian tendencies in many respects. The manager of this fund, Mark Barnett, has got a very strong long-term record, but you're absolutely right, it has struggled in recent years. And sort of post the referendum, you know, we have seen a pullback on Brexit fears, which has affected many parts of his portfolio. So his portfolio, you know, tends to be more focused on the domestic UK economy, and hasn't benefited as much as large capitalisation companies that are global in their outlook and receive most of their income from overseas markets, where the benefit has come from the fall in sterling. I recently saw quite an interesting chart from the managers of this trust, which tried to describe the ratings of domestically focused UK companies. And it really showed that while earnings growth had been quite stable in those companies, the actual ratings in terms of price earnings ratios had dropped off to an extent where they were discounting quite a severe recession in the UK market, a recession of the severity that one might expect or could be forecast through a no-deal Brexit. And, you know, I think if you're discounting those sorts of values, that the prospects for a recovery on a different outcome would be quite enticing. So, you know, a contrarian idea with a good manager that has been out of favour. I think you could accuse me of hedging my bets a little bit by going for a growth fund and for a more value-oriented fund. If you look at the two portfolios, one is very overweight the areas where the other is very underweight, and vice versa. Again, each of these will have a place in a diversified portfolio, but... You know, I think the undervaluation of Edinburgh's does look quite attractive for a long-term investor.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this was the argument there with UK equities is partly what maybe looks like an undervaluation. But, you know, are there any other sort of reasons, perhaps positive reasons, for taking a contrarian view and sticking with or even adding to UK equities?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, as we've seen since the referendum, we've seen outflows from open-ended funds investing in the UK. I think they total about £11 billion now. And there's, you know, clearly been a move towards overseas assets, which, again, have benefited from the weakness of sterling. I really don't get involved in currency forecasting. I think it's very difficult. I've never really met a currency manager that's been consistent in delivering returns. But, you know, it strikes me that, you know, sterling has the potential to recover from these levels, although equally it has the potential to fall further. But it really comes down to fundamental valuations. As this money has flowed out of the UK has been the least favoured market by international investors as well, we're at a situation where valuations are starting to look quite attractive. You know, I think in those trusts that have that exposure to the domestic facing businesses, that those valuations now start to look quite attractive. You know, I've been adding to positions in trusts like Aberforth Smaller Companies, which is a traditional dyed-in-the-wool value investor, which, you know, has been held back in many respects by Brexit concerns. If you look at the valuations of their portfolio, if you look at it in terms of enterprise value to earnings, you'll find that its discount to growth type companies is probably at an extreme level, probably at levels we haven't seen really since the run up to the TMT crisis in 2000. And again, I think that fundamental value is something that attracts me as a contrarian and will serve investors well over the next 5 years.
Yes. Now, you mentioned Aberforth Smaller, and obviously its focus is on smaller companies. I mean, these have been particularly hard hit by Brexit uncertainty. Do you think they're a good way to play these themes in particular, or could, you know, would you argue that in some cases they cheap for a reason?
In some cases, clearly there are. I mean, we're all faced with the impact of disruptive businesses impacting on many more areas of the economy than just retail, and this is going to be an ongoing process. But I'm not altogether sure whether all of these businesses are going to be gobbled up by the new disruptors over time. And I think a lot of these businesses will be able to adapt to the challenges of the future. So, you know, certainly there are areas where I think investors should be focusing for the future. There's good value out there.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Aberforth smaller companies. Are there any other UK smaller companies trusts that you think are a good option for trying to capture these opportunities?
Well, strangely enough, discount ratings in among smaller companies trusts have narrowed in quite a bit in recent times. You know, there are some very experienced and very successful fund managers at large in the smaller companies space. Neil Herman at Henderson Smaller Companies, the various management teams at BlackRock, with BlackRock Smaller Companies and BlackRock Throgmorton Trust, in addition to the more value-oriented fund managers like Aberforth.
Yeah, and is there any particular reason why the discounts have come in at a time when the asset class is not so popular?
Well, you say not so popular. The performance has actually been quite good. The performance delivered by many of these smaller companies' trusts, despite the Brexit concerns, has actually been rather strong.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Some really interesting ideas. And see this week's magazine of a website for more analysis on UK smaller companies' investment trusts. That brings us to the end of today's show, but see this week's Investment Trust special issue of Investors Chronicle or the website for professional investor suggestions, a roundup of the most highly rated trusts, and an update on our Investment Trust income portfolios. Also, don't forget to enter our competition to win £5,000 to invest in the trust of your choice. Thank you for listening.